So theoretically, anyway, we are all aspiring bodhisattvas. We want to become bodhisattvas. So there's two types of bodhisattvas, the modest faculty ones and the sharp faculty ones. So the modest faculty ones cultivate bodhicitta basically based on faith. Their teachers tell them how wonderful it is, tell them about their merit. They read the inspiring stories of previous bodhisattvas and teachers, and they feel quite enthusiastic and on that basis generate bodhicitta. The sharp faculty disciples don't generate bodhicitta off the bat like that. They want to know first, is it possible to become fully awakened? So to decide that, they investigate the ultimate nature. They meditate on emptiness. And through getting a conceptual understanding of emptiness, they come to see that it is possible to eliminate the afflictions and the cognitive obscurations. And so seeing that liberation and full awakening are possible, then on that basis, they generate bodhicitta. So you can see that there's a difference in those two kinds of disciples, and there's a difference in the quality of the compassion that they generate too. Clearly, the people who generate compassion based on an understanding of emptiness, their compassion is going to be more stable, more broader. So we aren't born either modest faculty or sharp faculty. We can go from being one to being the other. So right now we may mostly be modest faculty, taking things on faith, having correct assumptions, but without really understanding. But it's possible to increase our intelligence and our wisdom in this life so that we become sharp faculty disciples. And by understanding emptiness and that in awakening is possible, then dedicating our lives to being of the utmost benefit to sentient beings by attaining full awakening. So either way we go, let's generate that motivation now. Okay, so a few people did their homework. I didn't print out all of them, just some of them, because they also arrived at different times in the day. And I won't go through every point in all of them, but there's some quite interesting things that are good to discuss. Okay, so we start out more in line with what the text is, where we're talking about correct assumers as related to philosophical views. Yeah, because that's what the text is talking about. You know, it's trying to get us to understand what are reliable cognizers in terms of philosophical views so that we can come to understand emptiness correctly. Okay, so somebody wrote out a couple of the, you know, doing the privations and wanted us to check them. Okay, so what are the possibilities between direct perceivers and sense consciousnesses? Okay, is there something that is both? And if so, give, say what it is. Okay, so the eye consciousness apprehending blue, yeah, is a direct perceiver and is a sense consciousness. Okay, is there something that's a direct perceiver but not a sense consciousness? Okay, a yogic direct perceiver. Yeah, so it's a direct perceiver, but it's not a sense consciousness. Yeah, is there something that is a sense consciousness that is not a direct perceiver? Okay, so a visual consciousness seeing two moons. It's a direct perceiver. No, it's not a direct perceiver, but it is a sense consciousness. Okay. And is there something that's neither of them? Form. Okay. Can you give an example of a consciousness that is neither of them? Okay, so conceptual consciousness, thinking of the color blue. Or thinking of the mess in Washington. It's really getting messier and messier. So make prayers for those people. No. He said he'll keep it closed for months and even years if he needs to get his wall. Okay, so you put that there's 4P, but that's not correct. Oh, no, it is. It is correct. Yeah, sorry. Okay. Okay, so we did that. Okay. Okay, so did you get your question answered okay? Your question had to do with.
Yeah, my question had to do with that the.
Okay. Why an
icon? The one that was both. The one I picked that was both was one that was like a direct perceiver where the object appears but is not ascertained.
Yeah.
And
that one is
a direct perceiver.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a direct perceiver and it's a sense consciousness.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. I personally have a bit of a trouble with saying it's a direct perceiver because it doesn't really perceive anything. But according to the definition, it works.
What they said in mind in Tibetan Buddhism was, I am, but I guess I need to put it closer. What they said in mind in Tibetan Buddhism is that they bring this up to let you know that a direct perceiver doesn't always realize its object.
Right.
Was the point. And yeah. It does meet the definition of a direct perceiver.
Mm-hmm.
It does meet the definition
of
a direct perceiver.
Yeah, that's what I said.
It just seems kind of funny.
It just seems very funny because a wrong consciousness also doesn't realize its object, but it's not considered a direct perceiver. Like the one he gave, seeing two moons. Yeah. So why one is considered a direct perceiver and the other isn't? Well, because they say that the wrong consciousness is mistaken with respect to its engaged object. But the one that appears where it doesn't ascertain, it doesn't seem to have an engaged object. Yeah? So, I don't know. That's just what they say. Okay. Then, okay. Then we have one. Okay. So here's somebody, an attempt at an example of the three types of correct assumers. Okay. So correctly assuming consciousness without a reason. And so the example was hearing about rebirth as a new Buddhist and accepting it wholeheartedly with the perspective, yes, of course, that makes total sense. Yeah? Is that a good example of a correct assumer without a reason? Okay. Then a correctly assuming consciousness that has not really ascertained the correct reason. So after receiving some more teachers, coming to understand and gain further conviction in rebirth on the basis of the mind being a beginningless continuity of mental moments, but not really grasping the full meaning of this. Okay. So she gave an example of a syllogism. The subject, all sentient beings, past and future lives exist because the mind is a beginningless, indestructible continuity of mental moments. The syllogism isn't properly stated because the subject, sentient beings, is the reason because the mind is a beginningless, indestructible continuity of mental moments, does that apply to sentient beings? No, it doesn't. Okay, so the reason doesn't agree with the subject. Okay. Huh? Okay, the subject is all sentient beings. Okay. The predicate, as you wrote it, is past and future lives exist. Okay, that's not the correct way to state the predicate either.
The subject is actually for all sentient beings. Like, because I was trying to follow the example of on that Smoky Mountain pass, fire exists because there is a strongly billowing smoke.
Yeah,
so for all sentient beings, there's...
No, because on that Smoky Pass is the subject.
Yeah.
In the one you gave. So then for all sentient beings must be the subject in the syllogism you gave.
Yeah, and so for all sentient beings, the mind is a beginningless, indestructible continuity of mental moments. That applies, doesn't it?
No, I wouldn't think so. Yeah, I think it would be better because the one, the Smoky Mountain Pass, you're proving it by cause and effect. This reasoning that you gave isn't really a cause and effect one. Okay? So I think you need to make what you want to prove is your subject is actually past and future lives. And what you want to prove is that they exist. But even more, I think it would be better, you have to make them, if you want to use that reason, your subject has to be something about the mind. Okay. Because your reason is about the mind. So the subject will have to be something like that also. Okay. Then the example of a correctly assuming consciousness depending on a faulty reason, such as a reason with no privation, okay, would be for all sentient beings, past and future lives exist because there is an indestructible, unchangeable aspect of the self that does not die. So again, I would think you might want to reword that syllogism, but definitely that would be an example of a wrong reason. Okay, and then there were some interesting questions about Jeffrey's class, which I'll go into, okay, because they're on the sheet and you have to answer them sometime. So the person, she was saying, when I was purifying, I tracked the negativity back to arrogance. So I had the mental factor of arrogance in my mind stream. If we take the idea that the basis of designation is not the designated object and apply to arrogance, I get a bit stumped. Okay, so when you take a mental factor like arrogance or anger or faith or whatever, what is the basis of designation for it? Yeah, the many different moments of that mental factor. The mind in general isn't the basis of designation for it. So, but the many different moments of it is the basis in which, and dependence upon which you designate a mental factor or any kind of mental state. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, and she was saying she got stumped because, she wasn't thinking mental moments. So then it just seems, you say arrogance, and it seems like arrogance is one solid concrete thing. And so then it seems like the basis of designation would be the object designated. But it's not, because you're designating independence upon, a continuum of a certain mental state that has a common quality. Okay. So I think that's done. Okay. Then, okay. Then somebody says, I realize that living at the Abbey really makes clear just how many wrong consciousnesses I have within a day. Anybody else begin to see this? Okay. Each morning, I was sure I had a correct inference about what I was going to do that day, such as give my tree a walk or practice debate or change air filters in Chenrezig Hall. But then other things transpired and turned these into wrong consciousnesses. Okay. Can you have an inference about something that's going to happen in the future? No. Okay. When you have inferences, you're trying to show that you're trying to prove a quality of the subject. Okay. So, but you said that. She said, I also realized that any statement about what will happen in the future cannot be considered an inference and is at best a correct assumption. But very quickly turned into, they weren't correct assumptions. Okay. So in the book, the way correct assumptions is being taught is so that we can, understand a philosophical topic. And here what we're doing is we're taking that and applying it to our daily life. So it's not going to fit exactly. Okay, and so don't try and think that everything in your daily life, like what is going to happen today, has to be an inference, because as you discovered, you really can't make a correct inference about the future. Yeah, and inferences aren't for the purpose of predicting the future. Okay, they're for the purpose of showing what a quality of the subject is. Okay, but it's interesting. We seem to make inferences about the future, don't we? We seem, but actually they're assumptions. They're not really inferences. Yeah, I mean, even the weather person makes assumptions about the future using some kind of reasoning, but you know, it basically turns out to be an assumption that may be correct or may not be correct. Yeah. So I wonder, you know, can you call what the weatherman does? You know, the clouds are here, so therefore the weather is going to be like that. You know, we make it into forms of syllogisms, but I don't think it can really be, because there's so many factors involved in predicting the weather that how can you say, based on, you know, even the many factors that the weather people have, how can we say for sure what the weather is going to be? So I guess we make it a syllogism into a syllogistic form, but it's not a real syllogism. Yeah, it's an intelligent guess that you get paid for. Yeah.
That's how they
get paid. Yes. 20% chance of the rain. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I noticed, you know, when was it, yesterday morning or the day before when it snowed? Snow had not been predicted. Yeah. But, okay, it came anyway. That's good. Okay, so here is somebody talking about their breakfast. I entered the dining room and I have a direct visual perception of tables, chairs, a serving table, the Buddha, and so forth. Okay, right? I also have a direct auditory perception of someone taking water from the hot water kettle. Well, actually, we have a direct auditory perception of the sound of the water being taken from the water kettle. We don't really, we're assuming a person took it. I think that, yeah, okay. Actually, okay, so we can say, yes, we saw the Buddha statue, yeah, but what that eye consciousness apprehended was the color and shape of the Buddha statue. Okay, then I sit down and I have a direct tactile sensation of my body meeting the chair. So actually the tactile sensation would be of the hardness of the chair. Yeah, based on your body meeting the chair. But that what you're actually apprehending has to be a tactile sensation, such as hardness. Okay. So then Venerable Tarpa says something before we start with the morning prayers, but I could not understand the content. Oh, now she understands how I feel sometimes. Not regarding you, but regarding. Maybe she. What'd you say? Oh, yeah. So maybe she made an announcement, maybe not. I lean towards an equivocating, uncertain consciousness. Okay, so she's doubting, you know, did I hear something or didn't I hear something? So that's, you know, equivocating. But you said you heard something. Yeah. So actually, then it wasn't equivocating because you knew you heard something. You just didn't know what it was you heard. Okay. We start chanting, but in my mind, I am still pondering what she may have said. I am holding on to the sound that is long gone. Good insight. Yeah. Memory. Something's gone in the past. The mind is here. You know, today is now. The mind is, okay, what happened then? Yeah. The grasping is based on a memory that is filtered through multiple sense and mental perceptions. It is not the original announcement that Venerable Tarpa may have made. Yeah, so you think you hear something, you're not sure, you start thinking, oh, what was it that she, maybe she could have said? Yeah, so what's happening there is a lot of conceptualization, okay, and guesswork. And it may be a correct assumption based on a correct reason that you don't understand, maybe a correct assumption not based on a reason or even on an incorrect. It could have been any of the kind of correct assumptions, what you're assuming she said, or it could be a wrong consciousness because maybe she didn't say anything. Okay. I am turning my attention to the serving table. I see the black big pot. As I know that Venerable Sultram was the breakfast cook, I am assuming that she may have boiled some eggs. She does that often when it is her turn. What you don't know is that she's not here. I was very mean. She asked me if we can have eggs during the retreat, and I said no. But she didn't tell you that. Okay, I told her she could blame me, but she left before she could. Where'd she go? Is she in the kitchen cooking eggs? Okay, I have an uncertain consciousness leaning towards something that is not factual. The pot indeed is used for many different kinds of meals. On this morning, it holds cornmeal to be served with cheese. Okay, so that was interesting. She made an assumption, it's going to be eggs. She had a reason, because Venerable Sultram was the cook and she often makes eggs. Okay. But actually, it was a wrong consciousness because Venerable Sultram didn't make eggs. Yeah. But how many times throughout the day do we make these kind of assumptions that may or may not be correct? Yeah, that's what I think is very good, you know, really examining what she did, every little thing, and checking it. And, you know, how many times during the day do we just assume different things? Yeah, and never check if there was any reason or a good reason or anything, you know? Yeah, it's the classic example of somebody says good morning, and then, you know, we make the inference, oh, they said good morning in that tone of voice, they must be mad at me. Yeah, perfect inference, we think. Yeah. At best, it's an assumption, and it's usually a wrong consciousness. Okay? And even if it's an assumption, how do we know it? Well, we make up some reason. I could tell by the tone of their voice, the way they said good morning, that they're mad. Yeah? How many times do we make these kinds of assumptions based on somebody? You know, especially, you know where this happens a lot? When people cut you off on the highway. Yeah? This guy cut me off. He wants to make me mad. You know, it's mind reading, isn't it? I know this other person's intention. Never bothered to ask them. but I know what it is. And therefore, because they wanted to make me mad, I will respond by getting mad, and I will go and cut them off. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, this is a very good example of how we just make incorrect inferences that aren't even correct assumptions. And you know what really taught me about not making assumptions about why drivers cut you off is I was with Mary Grace when her daughter Emma was being born. And Mary Grace was at home. She wanted to have a natural childbirth, and she was having contractions, and Emma wasn't coming out. And at a certain point, the midwife said, look, it's better to go to the hospital and, you know, have the baby there. So we put her in the car, and we start driving to the hospital. Well, you know, you have a pregnant person who's giving birth in the car. You know, you're not going to inch along. Yeah, you're going to, yeah. And so it made me really think, you know, the people that we drove by on the way to the hospital had no idea that there was a person, you know, a woman giving birth in the car, and that's why we were driving the way we were driving, you know, that there was no bad intention on our part. It was a compassionate attention for care for the mother and the child. But there was no way that anybody else on the road would know that. So it really made me think, you know, whenever somebody cuts you off, don't make that assumption that they're stupid, they're not looking where they're going, they want to make you mad, because there could be somebody pregnant in their car that's giving birth, or there could be somebody who's injured. Yeah, we have another friend, Kathy, who was having a, she was having a stroke and drove herself to the hospital while having a stroke. Okay? So don't assume bad things about people who don't drive well, because you don't really know what's going on. Yeah? She got to the hospital, and when they learned what she had done, they said, you should never do that. You should get somebody else to drive you. Well, she wasn't somebody to hang around and wait. She just got in the car. And
I was just thinking, before you told about the story of the woman who had to give birth, about this Italian person in Pomaya, and he had really trouble with containing his anger on the road. And then he decided to think of every driver, of somebody going to his wife who was already a wife pregnant, and every driver.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was his only way that he could, you know, drive in the Italian roads.
Yeah.
So I wonder, this is a sort of assumption you take on deliberately. You know, not every driver has a wife who's pregnant, but you take on that assumption because it suits you. You know, it's sort of a wrong consciousness, isn't it? But we do that often.
But it's not really a wrong consciousness, because the person knows it's not factual, and they're thinking that way for a good reason. So it's like, you know, the meditation on bones, where you visualize all of space filled with bones. They say that that isn't a wrong consciousness, because you're doing it for a reason, and also you know that isn't, the universe isn't really filled with bones. Yeah. So I think this.
Would it fit in any of the seven?
I don't think so. Yeah. But again, there's so many mind states that aren't one of the seven. Okay. Sitting down with my breakfast and starting to eat, a memory popped into my mind. If Venerable Jigme is attending breakfast, because she wrote me a note yesterday saying that she feels sick. Okay, so you're having the taste of the, what was it, the cornmeal with cheese? Was it a pleasant taste, a sweet taste, a salty taste? What'd you say? What?
She didn't choose that.
Oh, she didn't choose that. Oh, okay. Okay. So, but you're eating, and then, you know, you're wondering, okay, is Venerable Jigme here? Is she not here? So what does she do? Okay. So I thought for some moments that it could be that she's not at breakfast. I had an uncertain consciousness that was leaning towards something that is not factual. Venerable Jigme felt sick last night, and therefore... So she was inferring, Venerable Jigme felt sick last night and therefore would be sick today. But she wasn't. Okay? So another example of how we make a quote, reason, you know, that where the reason doesn't prove the subject. Okay? I can see her two tables in front of me, sitting and eating. Okay, so visual consciousness. Yeah. I conclude that Venerable Jigme, as she's sitting there with us eating her breakfast, is not sick. It's an inferential cognition. Were you sick when you were eating breakfast? Polenta and beans would do it, huh? Okay. I continue eating and use the time to make another inference in my mind. Venerable Jigme is prone to sickness, as all human beings are, because our body is very fragile. We all get sick, old, and die. Even the smallest bacteria can cause us to get sick and die. Nobody can counteract this fact. I am having a correctly assuming consciousness. Yeah? On the way to becoming an inference. Yeah? That, well, not about Venerable Jigme, but about all sentient beings being prone to aging, sickness, and death. During my contemplation, it seemed that something flew from the neighbor's plate in my direction. I continued eating for some moments. Not really yet sure if that really happened, but then I looked down on my robes and I saw some sauce on it. Who was throwing food at breakfast? Are you having a food fight in here? Okay, I had an uncertain consciousness leaning towards something that is factual. Okay, so this is really good, you know, checking our mind, and really it gives you a way to look at what's going on in your mind, doesn't it? Yeah, and so here, you know, we're looking at the different ways of knowing. That's one branch of the topic of low rig. Another branch is looking at the mind and mental factors. So you could go through, you know, here she did the exercise doing it with the different ways of the different kinds of mind. Not all of them know their object, but just with the different kinds of mind. But you could go through the same exercise looking at the different mental factors too. Yeah. So this is exactly what we're supposed to be doing. When we study low rig, you know, mind and awareness is taking what we study and applying it to our own personal experience so we come to understand how our mind works. Yeah. And so I think, you know, some people just from doing this exercise came to some very good conclusions. One of them being, don't try and make inferences about the future, and the really important one is don't assume that everything's going to happen the way you think it's going to. Yeah, because we have this funny kind of thing, like, this plan will happen as planned, because it's a plan. You know, the events in this plan will happen as planned because, you know, plans do not change, or, you know, or because it's a plan, and, you know, then you have to go into another syllogism, you know, and plans don't change. And if we sit and think about it, is that true, that plans don't change? I mean, it's like the most dumb thing we could think of, because we've had that experience over and over and over again that plans change. And yet, whenever there's a plan, we still think that it's going to happen as planned. Yes. Yeah. Especially if it's my plan. Yeah. So it's interesting, isn't it? You know, despite our own experience to the contrary, we keep holding on to the idea that things will happen as planned. Yeah? So, you know, these kinds of things are very helpful for showing us how dumb we are sometimes. Aren't we? Aren't we dumb? Yeah, we can get ourselves to the moon, but we can't even think clearly about breakfast. Yeah? Or think clearly about a plan. Did we finish? Not real. Okay, good. That's just where I am. Okay. So, of course, if you believe in something that is not real, it is impossible to know that you are believing in something that is not real. Yeah? We all believe that what we believe is true. Another dumb assumption. You know, that one's really dumb, isn't it? Otherwise, we would not believe it, you know? So the inference, whatever I believe, is correct because it's my inference, you know, because it's my thought. Yeah. Even so, as we have all experienced, some of our beliefs have turned out to be unfounded and false. Well, maybe that applies to your beliefs, but not mine, because I'm always right. So we think. So in relation to something that is not real, such as the assertion that sound is permanent, a person can have only the first four consciousnesses on this list of seven as follows. So one, a wrong consciousness, the confident belief that sound is permanent. Okay, what's another thing that you believe is true that may not be true?
I'm the best cook.
Okay. Okay, so the confident belief that Venerable Yeshe is the best cook. Yeah, is that a wrong? Yeah, it's a wrong consciousness. Okay. The uncertain consciousness, leaning towards believing something that is not factual, an uncertain consciousness tending to believe that Venerable Yeshe is probably not the best cook. Okay. Then you go to an equivocating uncertain consciousness that wavers between believing that probably she isn't the best cook and probably she is. Okay. And then the uncertain consciousness leaning towards believing something that is factual. Okay, which is tending to believe that probably she is the best cook. Because what a wrong one is that she's probably not the best cook. That she's probably not the best cook. Okay, so then if that's a wrong consciousness, then the one going towards the the doubt going towards the correct one would be that she is the best cook. Huh? That she is not the best cook. Okay, we started with the wrong consciousness that she is the best cook. And then we got to the... equivocating consciousness that maybe she is the best cook and maybe she isn't the best cook. And probably... No. The, what? We started with the assumption that probably she is not the best cook.
No,
that she is the best cook.
That's the wrong consciousness.
Okay, and that's the wrong consciousness. Okay, so that means we can never get to the correct statement that she is the best cook. Okay. Except she makes some pretty good chocolate chip cookies. Okay. It is not possible to further mature this consciousness in relationship to something that is not real, such as the belief that she is not, no, that that she is the best cook. No, I just couldn't imagine Venerable Yeshe saying that she's not the best cook. Okay. So you can never come to have a correctly assuming consciousness, an inferential consciousness, or a direct receiver that she is the best cook. Okay. Because if it's something that's not true, you can never come to have a reliable cognizer or even a correct assumption that statement that isn't true is. Okay. So put in mind clearly that this list of seven consciousnesses is not comprehensive. Okay, put that in your mind clearly. Yeah. According to the Buddhist layout of consciousness, there are consciousnesses that are not included here in this list of seven. What's more, this list is not even the main division of consciousnesses, which is well and truly laid out in Lhati Rinpoche's Mind in Tibetan Buddhism. Okay, so here he acknowledges that his seven aren't the way it's usually laid out. It seems that the main lesson here is the difference between what we know and what we merely believe. The first five in the list of seven are simply beliefs, some right and some wrong, or misperceptions. These descriptions of consciousnesses grow out of the consideration of what are and what are not reliable sources of knowledge. This is the topic of the next chapter. Okay. For now, please take away from this description of consciousnesses these two ideas. First one, there are things I do not know. Yeah, you can accept that. Okay. Second, there are things I believe that are not true. No, sorry. That's not true about me. Because everything I believe is true. Otherwise, I wouldn't believe it. Okay? So, I mean, if we look at our beliefs and how we hold on so tenaciously to our beliefs, thinking that they're reliable consciousnesses, when at best the most they could be is correct assumptions. Well, I mean, if they're a correct belief, you know, maybe they could be direct perceiver. But, you know, so many of our beliefs are just simply that, beliefs. They're assumptions. We have no proof for them at all. And some of them aren't even true. And yet, yeah, we have a difficult time acknowledging that to ourselves and to other people. We don't like to acknowledge that we could be wrong. Do we? Yeah. And even, have you ever had the situation happen where you're discussing or arguing something with somebody and you know what you're saying is wrong, but you say it anyway because you're too proud to admit that it's not correct? Have you ever been in that situation? Oh, a few of you haven't. Oh, you're so good. Yeah. The rest of us, yeah. You know, and we fight to the end of something just because, you know, either two things. Either because we cannot at all consider that we may be wrong, or second, we cannot admit that we're wrong, even though we know we are. Okay. And both of those happen because of pride, because of arrogance. Yeah. Because we think, again, wrong consciousness, that if I admit that something I think is wrong, it means I'm stupid. Okay. Is that a correct syllogism? You know, the subject I, or these, yeah, you know, the subject I, how would you make it into a syllogism? The speech that I just said can never be wrong because it is my speech. Isn't it? Yeah. Or because everything I say is correct. Yeah. So we have those kind of, you know, quote inferences, fake inferences. Yeah. And then we think, if the subject I am stupid, you know. Or no, you'd have to think of how, you would make it into a syllogism some way or another. But the basic outcome is if I admit I'm wrong, it means I'm stupid. Okay? And again, that's not true at all. But because of attachment to reputation, yeah, because of insecurity, because of pride, we think it's true. And so we never want to admit that we're wrong. And that gets us into some problems in our life, doesn't it? Yeah. When we don't want to admit that we're wrong. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, kind of this wall, you know what the wall is going to do? The wall is going to stop sexual trafficking. Yeah, it's going to stop all drugs. Yeah, it's going to stop, you know, the flood of illegal immigrants, most of whom are smugglers and criminals.
And terrorists.
Oh, yeah. It's also going to stop all terrorism. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, this is, yeah. And when you got elected based on building this big, beautiful wall, which it turns out that one of his advisors advised him to say that because it was such a great line when you're campaigning. You know, because everybody bought onto it and they're all chanting, build that wall, build that wall. And now it's his main campaign promise and he can't get the money to build the wall. He couldn't even get it when both parts of the Congress were Republican, but now he's finding a way to blame the Democrats. You know, so do you ever feel like you're living in an insane asylum?
In this case, given the list of what the world might possibly do, I think it relates to number two. There are things I believe that are not true.
Yep. Yep. And yet, you know, cannot say that. Yeah. Because then you lose face. And isn't that amazing about us human beings? We cannot endure losing face. People go to war historically to prevent losing face. We are more attached to our reputation than to our lives in many instances. Yeah? Huh? Or the lives of others, yeah. Because, I mean, in this example, look how many people are suffering because of the shutdown. But what I'm trying to point out is look at the way our human mind works, yeah, that we would rather die by fighting a war than lose face and look bad in front of other people. Yeah? Isn't that? How many arguments have we personally been involved with because we don't want to lose face? How many wars have been fought so that you don't have to lose face? Yeah? And when you think about it, I mean, this is when they talk about ignorance being the root of samsara, this is a very good example of it. You know, how completely foolish it is to be attached to reputation. Because what is reputation? Yeah. Other people, it's your imagination of what other people are thinking about you. And you will give up your life for that. Many people will. Okay? So I'm pointing this out, you know, so that we look inside and we look at the parts of ourselves that get very stubborn and hold on to things tenaciously, like my little brother holding on to that tricycle at the bottom of the swimming pool, you know, even though it's bad for you. How much we hold onto something. Okay? And to look in our own minds and explore, you know, when do I do that? And what's the outcome in my life of behaving like that? Yeah. What result does it bring in this life? What kind of karma am I creating? What kind of results will come in a future life? Yeah. And so this is, you know, I think a very good way to learn about how our mind functions.
Someone online mentioned a book called Being Wrong by Catherine Schultz, and it talks about this topic at length. I don't know if anyone's read that book here.
Being Wrong.
Yeah.
Sounds right up my line. Yeah.
Just thinking about when I couldn't admit that I was wrong, when I argued with people and couldn't admit that I was caught in the midst of afflictions. Whereas now, if I'm in the middle of something, I can, there's an acceptance within the Buddhist worldview that there's acceptance within the Buddhist worldview that we're under afflictions, that things come up and that things happen. So mm-hmm. Here at the Abbey, I've given myself the permission to be able to like say to myself and to others, yeah, I'm stuck in the middle, I'm afflicted, I'm sorry, and kind of cut the crap mm-hmm. there. Whereas I can see before, there's not necessarily a social acceptance of or it's not explained. So literally, like, there are afflictions, we act under the influence of them, we get into arguments, it's okay, this is, like, it's not to indulge it. So there's not that permission almost, just to... that's what inhibited me.
I think there's the permission. We're too frightened to take it. Everybody says everybody makes mistakes. Yeah? So there's nothing wrong in saying I made a mistake, because everybody says, yeah, everybody makes mistakes. But we don't want to dare do that, because we'll lose face. Yeah. I don't think society's preventing us from doing it. We're preventing ourselves. Yeah. There are some things we cannot put on society. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, have you ever... Look, in the teachings here, how many times do I say I made a mistake? You point something out to me. We're online. I don't know who's going to watch this. You know? It's going all over the world. And how many times have you people pointed out that I said something that was wrong, like about her being a good cook? And I have to admit in front of online, you know, that I was wrong. Yeah. Okay. So it's doable. Yeah. I'm not getting, you know, bad looks from the eye of the camera. You know, you cannot dare say that. You know.
Mm-hmm. One of the most profound moments of my life, because I grew up in a house where nobody was allowed to say they were wrong. And so I was in college and I was with some friends, and one of the people there goes, oh yeah, I really screwed up, just like that. And I went, you can do that? And the ground is not going to open up? Wow, that's amazing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. You know, we hold this incredible fear that, you know, nobody, that we're just going to be totally under the earth and nobody will ever respect us again if we admit we're wrong. You know, but is that a reasonable assumption? Yeah. I mean, really, it's not. Like I told you, when I talked to this one, I met somebody who was, he worked at a university, and he would screen people's applications for a graduate program in science. And I asked him, what did he look for in people's applications and interviews? And he said, I look at how they act when they fail. Yeah. And that makes sense, because if you're a scientist, probably you're going to do a lot of experiments and have a lot of theories, and they're not going to be right, and you're going to fail. And what do you do when you fail? And that's the criteria he looked for when seeing who to admit into a graduate program in science. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Yeah. Would you want to admit into the program somebody who could never admit they were wrong? That kind of person would bring infamy to your university, because they would change all the results of whatever, you know, experiments they did. They would finagle the statistics or, you know, do something, because they could never admit they're wrong. And then, of course, somebody else would find that out. And then your whole university's reputation is trashed. So he goes on, we are all pretty comfortable with the first of these, which is, there are things I do not know. Sometimes we work diligently to try to get control of what we do not know. Sometimes we rest easy in not knowing and knowing that we do not know. It is the second one we find often, we more often find disturbing. We believe what we believe, and we believe that we believe correctly. Just to entertain the possibility that there may be things we believe that are not true, and we all do this sometimes, shows a measure of open-minded inquiry. Debate and analytical thinking require this. So he's going to go on to say that if you can't admit you're wrong, yeah, then learning analytical thinking and debate is not going to work for you. And you're not going to learn anything because you can't admit you're wrong. Yeah. Within the traditional Buddhist setting for this description, it is mainly a guide and a set of standards for something positive, sorting out what is actual knowledge and what is not. However, in the context of modern Western society, this list also serves as an escape from the all-too-common idea that it is impossible to know anything. Now, in this age of relativism, it is important to recognize that we know many things. Often we are beguiled and our confidence is attacked. For example, some suggest that we cannot even know that what we cannot even know what we perceive directly. Under the influence of the slumber of relativism, many say things such as, we can never really know whether the earth is flat or not. A few weeks ago, there were people in this class who were stating Mount Meru existed. Yeah. I understand that relativism does not generally assert that the earth is flat, only that consciousness is flat. For such people, no amount of evidence will ever lead a person to knowledge. Even if we can put such thinkers in a spacecraft and shoot them into orbit and, looking out the window, point out to them, see, the earth is largely spherical, not flat, they would still deny that they could know that. They would explain that the appearance is perhaps a misperception, that if you close one eye, it still looks flat, that perhaps the image is created by an evil genius merely trying to beguile us, and so forth. Conspiracy theorists! That's it. Yeah? This view may strike some as part of the sophisticated reserve of the intellect, but it strikes others as mere childishness. It is not so much a serious philosophical position as an emotional reaction. Despite the overwhelming evidence of the curvature of the earth, both from the ground and the sky, do these people really believe that the assertion of a largely spherical earth is a mere conspiracy? Yeah, even, you know, some of my teachers who were certain that the earth was flat because Vasubandhu said so, and Vasubandhu would never say anything that was incorrect, when they talked to their Geshe friends on the other, you know, in India, when they were in the West, and it's sunlight, it's daytime here and it's dark in India, they began to change their idea. But it took doing that to get them to consider that the earth was round. Otherwise, they were not going to believe it. But in the face of that proof, then they believed it. Do they really think that all the people who have gone into space have been coached and coerced into thinking into continuing a worldwide deception? Do they think we could never really know the truth of it? Well, Paul Manafort thought but no, that they would never find the truth of what he was doing. You know? Yeah, that's another example of our ignorance. Paul, you don't know who Paul Manafort is? Oh, he was a lobbyist he worked with Ukraine as a lobbyist, you know, and then he was part-time one of Trump's campaign managers. And what he was doing was he was getting paid tons of money from Russia for siding with the Ukrainian president that sided with Russia. And then he was taking that money and putting it in offshore banking accounts and not declaring it as income. And so, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And he got busted. Yeah, he got busted big time. Okay. And then there's some exercises to do with your debate partner by yourself. So I think that's good. I was very happy to hear that many of you a few days ago met together and went through some of these. That's really nice. And especially some of you who haven't been here since the beginning of the class, you're walking in the middle, and that you actually, you know, are jumping in and taking part and, you know, doing some of these kinds of things. I think that's really good. Okay. So one exercise, he says, if you have not already done so, please develop the habit of being reflexive about your own perceptions and thoughts. Try to find where they would be on the list of seven above. Notice especially when you are ranking something as knowledge when it is not real knowledge. Okay. So then we go on to the next chapter. Any questions so far? Yeah.
So I have a question about an uncertain consciousness I'm having. Mm-hmm. That's 50-50. So currently my visual consciousness is apprehending various external forms, such as Buddhas. I'm just kidding. Not Buddhas. But when I close my eyes, I see various like technicolor type things. Are those moments I'm perceiving, are those with my visual consciousness or my mental consciousness? Like when I close my eyes, I see colors.
Okay, so when you close your eyes, you see colors and things like that. Okay, so that's going to be a mental consciousness. Okay, because your eye consciousness isn't functioning, but your eye consciousness would have caused that, I think.
I mean, it's my visual consciousness is still functioning, but it's just not like manifest per se, like as if I'm asleep.
No, because for your visual consciousness to be functioning, it has to be through the eye as the organ. So if your eyes are closed, your eye faculty isn't operating, so the visual consciousness is not perceiving the object.
So there's no way to perceive the inside of my eyelids, per se? There's no light? I mean, but maybe there is. I don't know. I've never...
I think from a scientific perspective that the after images you see when your eyes are closed, you know, may need to check me on this. It's been 20 years since I took the class, but I think you're seeing you've exhausted some of the pigments, there's like an image on your retina, and you're still seeing the image on your retina, even though your eyes are closed, so you're not seeing outside, mm-hmm. but you're seeing an image that's inside your eye, and then mm-hmm. it fades out.
Mm-hmm. There are different views about why you have those after.
It's hard to map what the question she's asking into this philosophy, because there are completely different ideas about how we see.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're going to either answer it one way or the other way, but this is MX. Mm.
I thought we determined that the rods and the cones were the eye sense faculty.
Yeah.
Or could be. So it would be an overlap.
Yeah. But, like she said, they don't take they aren't taking those things into consideration here. Yeah. And they don't know about rods and cones. Yeah. So they wouldn't know, oh, the rods and cones are still firing. They just say, you know, the eye faculty is not functioning, so it's not the visual consciousness. You know, in the same way that they don't know about how color works. And so I think the snow actually is blue, because I was reading about it, the red and yellow color waves are being absorbed. So the blue is being reflected. So the snow actually is blue. Yeah. But from the point of view of this culture, who doesn't understand how that works, it's a wrong consciousness. Okay.
Someone had a question about your motivation, about the bodhisattva vows.
Uh-huh.
And when you take them, do you take the 37 vowels or the 18 root and 46 auxiliary or all of them?
37? Where did that come from?
I guess it's the practices.
Oh, okay. The 37 practices of bodhisattvas are practices that bodhisattvas do. They are not part of the bodhisattva precepts. Okay. In the Tibetan tradition, there's 18 root and 46 auxiliary bodhisattva precepts. Okay. In the Chinese tradition, it's different. Okay.
So you take the 18 root and 46 auxiliary.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. The 37 practices of bodhisattvas, yeah, that's something different. They're not precepts that you're assuming. Their advice that Tongme Zampo is giving us about how to work with our mind.
Can I follow up on the question I had from Jeffrey's class? I had more time to think. Oh, no.
Yeah, if you talk louder, maybe I can hear you.
Okay. From the question from Jeffrey's class around basis of designation and designated object, I still get hung up on the thing around, you can designate a thing, the basis of designation of a cup, we can label a vase and it can function differently.
Yeah.
But in terms of a mental factor.
But that has nothing to do with the price of tea in China. Okay. The fact that you can label this a vase or label it a cup, you know, does not prove that calling a series of moments, of mind moments that have similar quality tried, it does not prove that that's incorrect to do that.
I was just trying to draw the an equivalence around, like, wouldn't if arrogance is empty of inherent existence, then shouldn't it be able to function in a different way, like another object can function?
Not necessarily. Yeah. I mean, arrogance functions to, create negative karma. Yeah. Is arrogance ever going to function to create virtuous karma? Highly unlikely. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that there's something inherently existent in arrogance that makes something arrogant. Okay. There are some objects, you know, where you can, that can perform multiple functions. There are other objects that can't, but still those objects exist by being merely designated, and still they exist in relationship in a certain context. They don't exist independently. Okay? Yeah. So the fact that you can call something by more than one name doesn't mean that something you can't call by more than one name inherently exists. Okay. Should we start the next chapter? 5 minutes. Okay. The ancient spiritual siblings of Mother India, Jainism, Hinduism, and Buddhism, are all wisdom traditions. This means that they are based on the realizations and insights of great teachers of the past, and that they all hold that suffering as well as death is related to a failure of wisdom. At least from the time of the Vedas forward, all of these traditions have held that a person may be freed from the constraints of suffering and death by the power of wisdom, by seeing the nature of things. Do you think there was that belief in Western culture? In Western culture, that a person may be freed from the constraints of suffering and death by the power of wisdom, by seeing the nature of things? Yeah. You know, it's interesting that, you know, it seems like, I mean, maybe some of the great philosophers from universities, but certainly not the religious traditions, you know, that's an idea that's so very different from the religious traditions in the East. Yeah, quite amazing. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. I don't know if anybody studied philosophy. I took one course, and for only thing I remembered is P and Q. you know, to see if any of the great philosophers historically thought that human beings could be freed from the constraints of suffering and death by the power of wisdom. Moreover, it has generally been the opinion of these traditions, the ones in the East, that achieving this liberating wisdom is within the capacity of each and every one of us. That's certainly not in Western religions, is it? They assert that the problems that afflict us may be cured by the power of wisdom. Thus, in this effort to develop clear, accurate wisdom, one of the approaches that Indians adopted millennia ago is the tradition of philosophical debate. You know, just reading this and how he's really praising, you know, the whole Indian tradition, all these different philosophical schools for having these common beliefs that are really quite optimistic, even though the Buddhists spent a long time refuting them and having very different beliefs, but still some of the core beliefs are very similar. You know, His Holiness, one of the main things he's saying now is that he really wants the world to know about the ancient Indian traditions. He's not saying Buddhism. He's saying all the ancient Indian traditions and really praising, you know, including all of them. And I've heard him say that several times and thinking, but we refute so many of those beliefs. Why are you wanting, why are you thinking that they're a human treasure that, you know, everybody should know about? And this is why, because some of the basic foundation beliefs are really quite wonderful, you know, that it's a problem of wisdom. That's why we suffer, that human beings have the potential to attain liberation through generating wisdom. Yeah. Buddhism, you know, debates about what is that wisdom and what is ignorance. Yeah. But still the basic idea is quite optimistic about human beings and very different than our culture. In India, debate was so valued that if a person lost a debate with an opponent, that person would have to convert to the view of the winning opponent. It makes sense. I mean, if somebody was espousing something that could be proven with reason and you were espousing something that couldn't, it made sense, if you're looking for the truth, that you would, you know, become a disciple of the other person. Okay. If a guru debated with another guru and lost, not only the guru, but also all of his disciples, too, would have to become disciples of the winning guru talk about losing face. Oh my goodness. The thought behind this sort of custom is a radical commitment to consistency of explanation and integrity of view. If a debater could not put forth a sensible view and defend it, then that view must be flawed and it should be abandoned. If another puts forth a view that cannot be harmed by debate, then we should accept it. That's what His Holiness says all the time, isn't it? Yeah. In this atmosphere of such lively debates, naturally the discussions came to the vital issue of what we can depend upon as reliable sources of knowledge. How can we begin to sort out what is real and what is not real if we do not have reliable tools to use? Yeah, and our only tool is our mind. So then what are reliable consciousnesses? In the long history of Indian spirituality, different groups settled on different answers to this issue, which we can call valid or reliable cognition, or the sources of reliable cognition. As mentioned in the previous chapter, the Buddhists settled on there being only two reliable cognizers, inferential cognizers and direct perceivers. In his Pramnavartika, commentary on Dignaga's compilation of reliable cognition, Dharmakirti proves extensively that there are only two prime, that is, reliable cognizers, by way of showing that more than two are unnecessary and less than two would not include them all. In the third chapter of Commentary on Dignaga's Compilation of Reliable Cognition, the chapter on direct perceivers, Dharmakirti says, because the objects of comprehension are two, reliable cognizers are two. Objects of comprehension are divided into specifically characterized phenomena, which are objects suitable to appear explicitly to direct perceivers, and generally characterized phenomena, which are objects that must appear to thought consciousnesses. Since all objects of comprehension, that is, all existence, are the objects of just these two sorts of consciousnesses, Buddhists assert the need for just these two sources of reliable cognition, one direct and the other a thought consciousness. Okay, so within this system of Satantrika, yeah, you know, dividing it into what they define as specifically characterized phenomena and generally characterized phenomena, and then correlating that with the two kinds of reliable cognition, that's different than the way the Prasangikas correlate it. Okay, but within the Satantrika system, it makes sense. Remember last week I was saying that the Prasangikas say you can have a direct perceiver of a permanent phenomena? Yeah, and the Satantrikas say you can't. So that's one big difference. Yeah, it would be very interesting to have that debate and see, you know, how the Prasangikas could, you know, prove the Satantrikas were wrong. Yeah. Yeah, this would be, write this down on our questions for Geshe Thupke. Yeah, I would like to really hear his idea about this. Yeah, because, you know, sometimes with these kinds of questions, it seems to me you would have to be a yogi and, you know, and have a yogi direct perceiver in order to say. But I wonder if there is a logical proof of, you know, a reliable reason that could prove that.
At this time when the, let's say, the gurus debated with each other, and then they had to admit that they had a wrong, a false logic, and went to the other tradition. And I wonder, because we see nowadays, like, you know, the government can't agree to some mistakes they make, or we can't agree to that, why did it seem that it was more common at that time or more acceptable? Was it a tradition, or did they have more abilities to accept their afflictions? yeah, I don't know.
There was probably, it sounds to me like there was a real commitment for truth, you know? And when there's a real commitment for truth, not a real commitment to saving face, then you would change. Yeah. You know the prayer that you recite after the 35 Buddha prayer? You know, you do the whole 35 Buddhas, which includes the confession, the rejoicing, and the dedication. And then there's the other prayer that starts out, woe is me. Okay, in Tibetan, you go, ooh-hoo-la. That's how it starts, ooh-hoo-la. The story behind that, I think, who was it? Was it Ashvaghosha? Anyway, one of the really brilliant non-Buddhist scholars lost a debate to, I can't remember who, Aryadeva? Was it Aryadeva? Yeah. Was it Maitrasita? Maybe, yeah, maybe. Yeah, okay. So I can't remember who it was. Yeah, maybe my Trissy did. Maybe Ashvaghosha. Anyway, so he, you know, he was vanquished because Aryadeva won, and he was in the library, and what happened? A book fell down or something, and he opened the book, and he really realized that, you know, what Aryadeva said was right. And then he went, you know, he realized his big mistake and all his arrogance. And he went, ooh la, you know, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the Ten Directions, please listen to me. And then he did this huge confession. Yeah? That's the story behind it. Yeah? So, you know, somebody who was a great leader, you know, totally losing face. And what did he do? He just completely opened up all of his faults, because that prayer has like almost every single horrible deed you could think of in it. And he just completely opened it up and said, I've done all this, and I'm not going to hide it. Wow. Can we do that, even with one thing we've done? You know, we struggle sometimes in Vajrasattva, don't we? Well, yeah, I know what I did wasn't right, but actually it makes a lot of sense that I did that. It was really right if you look at it in this other way, and the other guy needs to confess, not me. Yeah. So overcoming that is...